Hello, sex fans, and welcome back. Today is Monday, September 28th, 2009, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge, with your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick.
We could have a lot of fun together, you and I, and I think we'd be really good for each other.
Oh, good. That sounds like fun. But in the meantime, I have a spectacular interview for you. I welcome the granddaddy of gay comics, Howard Cruz. He's here as part of the Erotic Mind podcast series. As you know, for well over a year now, I've been chatting with noted erotic artists, both visual and literary, from all over the freaking world in an effort to try to uncover something of the creative process involved in this specialized art form. Howard is our most senior person to join me in this effort, and he brings with him a historical perspective unlike that of any other of my previous guests. In fact, I think it's safe to say that every gay or lesbian who has put pen to paper to create a comic or a cartoon over the last 40 years can trace his or her lineage back to the groundbreaking work of my guest. This is remarkable stuff, kids. You do not want to miss a moment of it.
You didn't realize I was gay. Okay, no. Look, I'm sorry. I've handled this badly.
No, I had you pegged from day one. Listen, be sure to check out the amazing world of Howard Cruz, including his personal blog on his site, howardcruz.com. This week's podcast is brought to you once again by the good folks at EdenFantasies.com, the one-stop place to shop for all the adult goodies you've been drooling over. Of course, you'll find a full line of top-quality toys, fetish kits, and sexy lingerie, but that's not what makes Eden Fantasies so damn special. What makes them so extraordinary is their social conscience, and that, my friends, makes all the difference in the world to a sex-positive guy like me. Their site is chock-full of tips for the conscientious consumer, practical user guides, and sex toy reviews, and their community blog, EdenCafe.com. You're going to want to check out this site, my friends. It's so fun and sexy, irreverent and cheeky, but it's also exceptionally informative. Look for the Eden Fantasies banner right there on the sidebar of DrDicksSexAdvice.com. You can link to the brilliant Eden Cafe from there. Okay, on with the show. Welcome, Howard, and thank you for dropping by DrDicksSexAdvice.com. It's so great to have you join us for this Erotic Mind podcast. Would you like to say hello to the nice people?
Well, hello, nice people. Thank you for dropping in.
So listen, in these interviews, I traditionally ask a lot of questions of my guests, but I would like to take a different approach with our time together. You've written a great deal about yourself and your work, and I would like to use your own words as jumping off points for our discussion. How does that work for you?
Let's give it a try.
And if it doesn't work, you can just tell me to shut
the
fuck
up.
I love it. Good, good, good. First, some background. You write, Howard Cruz's comic strips and humorous illustrations have appeared in numerous books and national magazines since he launched his career in the underground comic books of the 1970s. You must be the granddaddy of comic books, gay comic books, right?
Well, I think in the gay area, I sort of have that standing, although technically speaking, I was not the first gay underground cartoonist. There were two lesbians ahead of me, Mary Wings and Roberta Gregory. And also there was a comic book series called Gay Heartthrobs in the late 70s that preceded me, but gay comics sort of had a different goal of being a little more serious and less campy and frivolous than gay heartthrobs. And the work of Mary Wings and Roberta Gregory was actually, basically they set the tone that I wanted to set and encourage in gay comics, because they they were doing stuff that was very human and about the lives that people actually led,
right,
as opposed to just trying to be outrageous or fantastical.
Yeah. You continue to say, Howard Cruz is an exceptional cartoonist and was the founding editor in the 1980s of the underground comic series Gay Comics. He is most widely known for the Advocate's 1980 comic strip, Wendell, but also the groundbreaking Barefoots. In 1995, he released his now award-winning graphic novel, Stuck Rubber Baby. That's how I first encountered you, was your Wendell comic, because I was a Advocate subscriber, and that's where I saw your stuff first.
Well, that's interesting. By the way, to jump back a second, I can't believe that I would write that I was exceptional.
Somebody wrote that.
I don't know where you got that, but I didn't write that.
Oh, okay.
But yes, Stuck Rubber Baby, in many ways, was my breakthrough. Actually, in most ways, was my breakthrough book, in that it got the attention of a lot of people who were not gay.
Uh-huh.
The Wendell comic strip appeared in The Advocate, which is a magazine that is largely read by gay people.
Uh-huh.
And so consequently, I sort of built an audience,
right,
in The Advocate, but a lot of straight people didn't see it. And it made drawing the Wendell strips easy in some ways, because I didn't have to explain,
right,
anything about the gay subculture,
yeah,
to the
automatic
readers.
Frame of reference.
Exactly. But Stuck Rubber Baby has a mixture of gay and straight characters. It takes place in the 60s, before the Stonewall riots that were kind of ushered in the modern segment of the gay liberation movement.
Right.
And it reflected the way gay life was when I came out
right,
in the mid-60s.
Right. It's a flashback, would you say that?
Well, I mean, it's a, it's unrelated to the universe of Wendell, other than, I mean, Wendell, essentially I saw it as a humorous strip with serious subtext,
yes,
whereas Stuck Rubber Baby is essentially a serious story with humorous, humorous moments.
I see. Got it.
And Wendell was drawn in a more cartoony style.
Right.
The characters
good.
Have exaggerated eyes and not nearly as much shadings. Whereas Stuck Rubber Baby, I was making my somewhat pathetic effort to draw realistic. I'm what they call a Bigfoot cartoonist, which means that I'm most at ease when I can draw really exaggerated characters slipping on banana peels.
Right.
But the story of Stuck Rubber Baby demanded a certain gravitas in the style, and so it forced me to push myself toward realism, even though, in essence, if you compare my work to genuinely talented realistic cartoonists, you would immediately see the difference. I can't really capture the sort of illustrative realism of artists like Neil Adams and other outstanding artists, but I chose to believe that readers, if they were into the story, would forgive me my deviations from realism.
Yeah.
And I tried to return the favor by being as believably human-like in my characters as possible.
Mm. Interesting.
But you couldn't put them together with the Wendell characters, because they would look totally different.
Uh-huh.
So I don't think of it as any going back in time from the Wendell era,
mm-hmm,
but simply for me going back in time to a time in my life which was long before I would have ever have thought of drawing Wendell.
Ah.
And the character in Stuck Rubber Baby is not me, and he's,
uh-huh,
not an aspiring cartoonist, and there's no way that he would become me in later life.
Mm-hmm.
But the experiences he has in many ways mirrored experiences that I had when I was coming of age in Birmingham during the early and mid 60s.
Right. One other thing that I'm curious about, and that is that your style of comics is in a more traditional style, and that is that it not only has illustration, but it has words. You know, your characters speak to one another, generally speaking. They interact, and, you know, you're telling a story as well as illustrating a story.
Right.
A lot of the other more, I don't know, I wouldn't say modern, but younger, perhaps, people that I've been interviewing in this series, their comics are wordless, and they're telling a story only through illustrations, which is a curious kind of thing to me. I understand why they do it, because, you know, it's, you know, the pictures are universal, and, you know, language is not. Do you have a thought about that? I mean, why is it that you added words to your comic?
Well, it all depends on, you know, what the main purpose of your drawings
right.
Is or are. sorry about that. I mean, I'm aware that you've been interviewing some people who would fall under the category of erotic artists, is the way that they would
yes.
define themselves.
Yes.
And, of course, the purpose of erotic art is very different from the kind of character-based storytelling that I'm particularly interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I like to draw a world where sex is a part of the entire picture the way
right.
it is in real life.
Yeah.
But what mostly interests me creatively is what is going on in the minds of the characters, how people interact, what are the subtexts, the things mm-hmm. that they're not saying.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things, as opposed to a overtly sexual scenario, which I have done drawings that were all about simply being stimulating sexually, but they have a totally different goal.
Right.
Something like my regular comic books, where I'm trying to
right.
let's create believable characters and see how they interact,
yeah.
and you know, along the way they may have sex, but.
Yeah.
It's like people, you know, who have lives,
uh-huh. and not just sex organs.
Well, exactly. I mean, in most, you know, and when you're drawing for, you know, pornographic reasons, and I don't use the word pornography in any way judgmentally.
Right.
I've drawn pornography, but that's about stimulating fantasies about sex.
Right.
And when you're doing that, the last thing you want to do is be thinking about, oh, and after we have sex, I've got to go do the groceries and maybe I've got a job interview.
Uh-huh.
So you strip away the aspects of life that are non-sexual when you're drawing pornography.
Right.
Or simply something, an erotic fantasy.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I'm also discussing erotica in terms of written erotica, and I'm discovering that there are people who write erotica, like particularly short story erotica, that is predominantly, almost exclusively sexual. Not pornographic, mind you, at least not in the traditional sense of that word, but, you know, overtly sexual. And then there are people who are writing, like, erotic novels, and those are, you know, longer pieces, certainly not short stories, and they have to worry about character development and, you know, historical accuracy and all kinds of other concerns that, you know, the erotic short story author doesn't really have to worry about, because
right.
that, you know, it's all about getting on, getting off, and thank you very much kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect that, you know, and the people who are writing erotic novels are telling me, you know, that they write the novels, and, you know, the sex is, you know, organic to the story. It's not an overlay, but the whole idea is not to write an erotic novel. It's to write a novel that has eroticism in it, which is kind of an interesting thing.
Well, to me, it is simply not that sexy to just write about or draw the sex act.
Yes.
I mean, it's if you're just if all it's about is a sex act, I'd rather have sex.
Yes.
What is erotic is when you've created a sense of who a character is, so that you are identifying with that character, and if that character then encounters a sexual situation, you identify, and it has all of the elements of a sexual situation in real life, which is the anticipation, the process of getting undressed, the slow revelation of another person's body, and things like that.
Right.
That is far sexier. I mean, in general, most video porn leaves me cold because they skip the whole part.
Oh, it's so true.
About the slow discovery of a person and just jump to the fact that they're naked and you've got genitals filling the screen.
Yeah, right. Literally and figuratively. It's so true. I mean, and when I started my porn company, Daddy-O Productions, that was one of the things that I wanted to remedy because I saw this. I mean, for me, you know, the big turn-on was the seduction. When the seduction was missing, you know, guys would meet on the street and the next frame they were in bed naked, and I went, well, the best part was left out, you know how did they get there, how did they get their clothes off, where was all the heavy breathing and all that, which
sure.
I thought was really exciting. But
well, I mean, you know, speaking from a gay perspective, if you're in a situation that has sexual possibilities, I mean, the most sexy aspects would be becoming aware that you can tell that the person you're with has an erection underneath their thing. You know, that is, you know, before you've touched anything, you know, just that all of a sudden, I mean, charges in your awareness that you may too.
Yeah.
Things like that get left out. But of course, if you try to introduce that element into something that overall has a goal of being, something that someone's going to be excited by and probably masturbate to or something, you need good actors.
Yes. Those are hard to come by.
People willing to, get naked and fuck on camera, you're getting awfully lucky if you have someone who also can create enough of a nuanced character that trying to create those early moments would not seem laughable.
Yeah. Well, that's what I always said, the talent that I was employing for my movies, they were performers. They were sexual performers. They were not actors. And, actors, are generally not people who are interested in taking their clothes off and having sex in front of a camera. But sometimes you get those two things together, and it's really quite magical. So let me move on to another work of yours, a compilation, as I'm gathering, from Head Rack to Claude.
Mm-hmm.
This is your compilation of the work that you've done over many years, and the bookends are these two characters, Head Rack and Claude. Yes.
Right. Head Rack is a character who was part of the cast of characters of Barefoots,
right,
the series that I was doing back in the 70s.
Right.
And it's very cartoony, and the characters are proportioned entirely unrealistically.
Uh-huh.
And but I decided while I was doing that series, and I was not yet out of the closet professionally, mm-hmm. I was personally,
mm-hmm.
But I had the plan of being out of the closet professionally and bringing gay themes into my work. And Head Rack was a character who felt like he would be gay,
mm-hmm.
and is parallel to me in many ways, in that he was a frustrated artist with all sorts of insecurities and things, and that pretty much was me. But I wanted to establish him as a character for a while before he came out, because I wanted to avoid this phenomenon that was happening a lot in the mid-60s, where, for example, in sitcoms on TV, you had well-meaning producers who would bring on a gay character. For example, in the Mary Tyler Moore Show, I remember the character Phyllis had a gay brother.
Right.
So came on the show, and it gave everyone a chance, except the designated homophobe.
Right.
It gave everybody a chance to sort of either immediately be accepting or learn to be accepting in the course of a half hour.
Right.
And then that was essentially the last you saw of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want that sort of kind of liberal, pro-gay, rah-rah thing to be the reason for a gay presence in my work. I wanted it to be organic, so I established mm-hmm. Edrack as a friend of Barefoot's for a number of years mm-hmm. before the time came to a story about the fact that he's gay.
Right.
And so that was my entree into, in gay themes. And my book, From Hedrack to Claude, basically covers that first gay-themed story of mine all the way to the most recent, which is a short piece called Then There Was Claude,
mm-hmm.
That ran in the anthology Boy Trouble a year ago.
Mm.
And it does not include the Wendell series, which has already been collected into a book of its own, and it does not include Stock River Baby, which has gay themes mixed in with issues of racism and all sorts of other themes.
That stands on its own as well.
Exactly. But yeah. I had accumulated over the years a lot of stories, and as well as essentially political strips that I drew for the Village Voice about current events during the 1980s. Basically, I had accumulated a bunch of stuff that has now been out of print since the early 90s. I had an earlier anthology called Dancing Naked with the Angels that contained some of the material that's in From Hedrack to Claude.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a grab bag of gay, non-gay, all sorts of different kinds of undergroundy, above ground things.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this new book, brings back into print all of the gay themed material and other that was in Dancing Naked, but also that was drawn since Dancing Naked. And that's the purpose of the book. It's just bring all those short gay themed pieces together.
Great. So let me ask you about Claude then. If Hedrack is closer to you, like a biographical kind of character, then Claude is, you write, my fictionalized version of a sexy ministerial student with whom I had a brief romance early in my own period of youthful self-discovery.
Mm-hmm.
He appears as my bed partner in a 2008 memory strip called Then There Was Claude.
Right. Yes, this guy is a very, very nice guy. And this was, I was just discovering the gay world and sort of on the alert for the possibility of an extended relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And he was kind of a candidate for a few weeks. But I never stopped thinking he was a nice guy, but there was this paradox in that he was a ministerial student in Alabama college, and his intention was to remain in the closet and be a minister and have this side life as a gay person, and it seemed just very strange since at that time, essentially none of the mainstream religions, and certainly not the Baptist one that he was headed for, had anything good to say about homosexuals. So it was just automatic hypocrisy, and yet he was such a sweet guy.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of paradox you often would find, and you still do, but it was almost universal in the gay world, that people compartmentalize themselves. But I didn't see any future that relationship because I just thought one way or another he was going to self-destruct or be miserable or something along the line.
Yeah. Well,
in those days I would have told you that I would not be able to be an out cartoonist. It didn't seem possible.
Yeah.
There were none, but that wouldn't have been directly as hypocritical because cartooning does not inherently condemn homosexuality.
Right. Yes, I identify completely because I was a Catholic priest for many years, 20 years when my add. I was ordained in 1975. I was out, at least to my religious community and family members, before that, and I got into trouble with the church, needless to say. When I wrote my doctoral thesis in 1981 about the sexual attitudes and behaviors of gay Catholic priests in the active ministry, so I was tearing down the walls, not only my own, but you know, helping you know other gay priests do the same kind of thing, and other ministers and stuff. But it was a difficult time. It certainly is not the same. It's not the same like today. I know it's even difficult today for ministerial students and professional people of every stripe, you know, to integrate their sexuality and their sexual preferences into, you know, their professional life. But it, way back in the 70s, it was unprecedented. We didn't have any models. We didn't know how to be, you know, a gay Catholic priest, for example. I was like one of the first, and in fact, people used to say, you know, write about me in the popular media and saying, calling me the gay priest. Well, you know, it's like, what?
I spent some time being the gay cartoonist.
Yes,
too,
right. It's a completely different time. I mean, you know, a lot of the young people in our audience, you know, this is going to be completely unfamiliar to them because, you know, they've grown up in a world where, you know, gay life is often much more integrated into the popular culture than it was when we were.
Oh, absolutely.
Up. Yeah.
I assume it must have, during the period, and by the way, congratulations on your courage in trying to bring that. But I'm sure that it must have been building up to that decision. It must have been quite difficult.
Yes, and in trying to communicate that to other people, like men that I was having sex with when I was a ministerial student, and when I was after I was ordained, you know, and when they would find out about, you know, my other identity, and a lot of them, I think, you know, thought that it was hypocritical, and I said, well, in a way, I suspect that it is, but at the same time, I am committed to making these changes and helping my church, you know, my religious tradition, you know, overcome its homophobia in the same way that I was trying to do that for myself. And so it was a really difficult kind of thing because I was neither fish nor fowl. I wasn't accepted, you know, in the mainline church, and I certainly wasn't accepted by, you know, the gay community at that time, which had, you know, great animosity toward religious people, and rightfully so, God knows. So it was a really difficult time because I really didn't have the connection I hoped I would have, you know, with either one group or the other, or both.
And for all I know, the fellow who was the model for the character of Claude may well have become, you know, broken through and
yes.
become a serious gay activist.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know what became
yes.
of this.
Interesting. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. But it's funny how our lives weave like that. And, you know, I mean, I suspect that there are, you know, people who may have rejected me. Well, in fact, I know this for certain, you know, like, you know, for certain gay clergy who rejected me, you know, back in 1981 when I was going through all this travail with the church, but now are, you know, are out and proud, but they persecuted me, you know, because I was, you know, the first. It was tough. So yeah, it's a very interesting kind of thing to look back on.
I've often been tempted, if I had a way to be an extra person and it didn't take up time, to put together an anthology called Homophobic Writing by Gay Activists.
Yes. Oh, so true.
Because it's so many people have a history of trying to deal with their own insecurities about being gay by being super straight mm-hmm. to the world and often including homophobic things. And I have homophobic writings and things in my background.
Yes. Oh, as do we all. I mean, we are the product of our culture, you mm-hmm. know. I mean, and sloughing that off, you know, learning to, you know, make new thought patterns around old issues is, to my mind, what, you know, the maturation process is all about. The coming out process is precisely that, is letting go of those kinds of things that, you know, we were told as youngsters about stuff. if it isn't about gay stuff, then, you know, it's about race and about other religious traditions and all of that kind of stuff. We're mm-hmm. the product of our culture, for sure. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Interesting. Interesting. You wrote something that really caught my mind. You said, riots or no riots, becoming an openly gay cartoonist wasn't on my mind that June night in Greenwich Village. You're referring to the Stonewall riots in 1969, I'm assuming, yes? And you were there.
I was there, not rioting, not doing anything useful. Just wandering by in an LSD haze.
Yes, right, good.
We just happened upon it when it was beginning and didn't quite know what we were seeing,
yes.
Although I was familiar with Stonewall Inn because mm-hmm. it was a bar that I went to frequently. But this was during a year that I spent living in New York mm-hmm. in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back south and lived down south in Birmingham. Well, partly in Atlanta, but mostly in Birmingham for 7 years before I decided to make another stab at New York City.
Right.
And, but no, I was, my process of deciding to be open about being gay was a long one, and it involved me first breaking through my own internalized homophobia.
Right.
In general, the way I would characterize the attitude toward being gay in the Birmingham bars in the mid-60s was that, you know, yes, we're all sick in some way, but that doesn't mean we can't enjoy life.
Right.
And it took a long time for me to quite realize that the whole notion that there was anything out of order about being gay, that didn't come easily, and it really didn't come until I was in my first long-term relationship with a fellow named Don back at the beginning of the 70s.
Right.
And I, you know, I finally just had an epiphany in which I realized that everything about the way I loved Don was totally natural. It was in no way an aberration of nature. And once I had that epiphany and started thinking about all the torture I had been put through during my teenage years and my early 20s as I, one way or another, tried to compensate for being this somewhat twisted personality,
mm-hmm.
It had all been unnecessary. I could have just been having a self-discovery without that overlay of guilt and a feeling that my life was some way or another headed for disaster, and I had just been made miserable on certain levels for many, many years for no reason. And that caused me to feel quite angry and quite determined to combat that in the future, partly through my cartooning.
Yeah.
But I had also, the lessons learned from the civil rights movement, it took a while for them to quite be internalized. You had to sort of see Birmingham as it developed in the years after the explosion of violence during the 60s with the riots and the marches and all of that,
mm-hmm.
You had to observe how successful it was at changing Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me realize that individual activists really can make a difference. And so while I was not in any way thinking of myself in activist terms at the time that I stumbled upon the Stonewall riot, it planted seeds.
Yes.
And once I overcame my own internalized homophobia, then I realized that the only moral thing to do would be to try to prevent other generations of adolescents from going through the torture that I had gone through.
Right. And, you know, sometimes that crucible, you know, that really, really difficult crucible of not just being persecuted by the popular culture, but that we ourselves buy into that and being part of our own, being our own oppressors, because we haven't really thought through the, you know, the whole gestalt about, you know, why the culture persecutes. So, you know, and then that leads to this explosion, as you suggest, of, you know, coming out of the closet and not knocking the, you know, the doors off the hinges.
Right.
It's a good, healthy thing, it seems to me. It, you know, it's one of the ways of, you know, freeing ourselves in the same way that, you know, black folks finally threw off the shackles of Jim Crow and, you know, said no more.
Exactly. As much as it has a flavor of bumper sticker politics, yes. Phrases like "black is beautiful" were radical and important,
yes.
Because basically the racial characteristics common among, you know, people who are black were taught to view them as ugly.
Right. And then the gay liberation movement picked that up and said gay is beautiful, and
right.
You know, that was. For people like you and I of our age, I mean, that was the first time we ever heard such a thing, you know, that anyone, you know, heretofore, as you suggest, we were all sick and perverse and disordered and tragic. How interesting. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. Howard, I'm just getting started with you. I've got so much more to ask, so much more to discuss with you. May I ask you to come back and join us next week?
Certainly.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much. But before we go, could you give us your website address and or addresses and perhaps walk us around a bit?
All right. My web address is easy to remember. It's howardcruz.com. You just have to remember not to misspell Cruz. There's no I in it. It's not the Tom Cruise spelling. It's just C-R-U-S-E. But if you type that in and you arrive at a page that will lead you in lots of different directions at once, including my blog, what I call my comics vault, which has a lot of my old comics in it, and a section called Howard Cruz, the website, which is the more personal site with uh-huh. stuff about my life, as well as comics, and then a portfolio section for the stray art director who may be thinking about
something. Excellent. Thank you again for being so present to us, and until next week, we will be visiting you in cyberspace.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Howard.
Goodbye.
Bye. Fantastic show, huh? Well, that's it for today, sex fans. I'm so glad you could join me. Tune in next week for part two of my conversation with Howard Cruz and more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God!
No need to get all riled up, girlfriend. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Eden Fantasies. Listen up. At Eden Fantasies, you have a unique opportunity to both shop and educate yourself about all the swell adult products out there. Of course, they uphold a high standard of quality in the toys they carry, but they are even more focused on customer service and consumer education. Their site has developed an online community of product reviewers, an editorial staff, fantasy contributors, and renowned sexperts, including yours truly, Dr. Dick. In fact, you can find my ever-so-popular handy-dandy guide to penis pumps for men and those who put up with us. Just look for the Guides and Tips page, click on the guides, and you'll find me there, along with a load of other insightful contributors who provide a wealth of information about topics ranging from BDSM to the G-spot.
It's better than you don't tell me.
Well, actually, I do want to tell you because I think it's important. And I also want to turn your attention to Eden Fantasy's brilliant new e-magazine, Sex Is. You'll find tantalizing articles and informed opinions on sex, society, health, greening your sex life, erotica, and humor. And just in case you don't get a big enough dose of Dr. Dick here at DrDickSexAdvice.com, you'll find that I have a weekly column at Sex Is, too. It's called Dr. Dick on Demand. Look for the Sex Is banner in the sidebar of my site. And look for all of my podcasts on iTunes. You'll find me in the podcast section, obviously, and once there, all you have to do is search for Dr. Dick Sex Advice. And don't forget to subscribe. Feel free to leave a comment when you do. Until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex, that's even better. Over and out.